What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
Matt Odell is the co-founder of Final Message and co-host of the popular podcast episode Rabbit Hole Recap on Tales from the Crypt. In this episode, we discuss Bitcoin, mining, interest rates, Bitcoin Twitter, financial privacy, and where Matt believes we are going in the future. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well. Skirt, skirt! Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, Crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at Crypto.com. Go help your boy out, tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit Crypto.com. Pomp's got you, always. Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you gotta do is go to coinmine.com, you buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right, you purchase it, it shows up at your doorstep, you pull it out of the box, you plug it in, connect to your Wi-Fi, 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp set you, and thank me later.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only. All right, bang, bang. I'm here with Matt. This is a long time coming. Probably one of the most prominent Bitcoin maximalists in the world. Is that fair to say?
I mean, that's a little bit too intense. I don't know about that.
Too intense. Let's start with just your background and kind of how'd you get into Bitcoin? Like,
you know, I discovered Bitcoin in 2012. I thought it was gonna fail. I thought it could never work. And then it pumped in 2013, and while it was pumping in 2013, I was like, shit, maybe this could work. And I jumped into it, and I just tried to figure out how it couldn't work. And the more I went down that rabbit hole, I was more and more confirmed that it would work. Mm-hmm. And I basically came up with the conclusion that even if it didn't work long term, it would work short term, and I could make a bunch of money from it. And then the rest was history. It was, you know, my dad taught me from a very young age that if you invest in something, you should know what you're investing in. And just everything, you know, from there, I just, not only was I investing, but I had to learn as much as possible.
Real quick, there's a live stream going on for those that are just listening to this. Jack Mahler's coming in hot. What's up, brothers? What's up, Jack? So why did you think that it had a low probability of success when you first saw it? Was it just like, this is such an ambitious thing that it just naturally is a low probability? Or were there certain aspects of it that you didn't believe in or didn't understand? Or like, what would you say about that?
So we were post-Snowden at that point. Mm-hmm.
Post-Snowden in this, you said 2012?
Yeah.
Okay.
We were post-Snowden and we were post-financial collapse, right? Yep. In 2008, right? So I grew up into the financial collapse.
Yep.
And I was a New Yorker, so a lot of kids, their parents were Bear Stearns, mm-hmm. and Merrill Lynch and everything. And I saw that unfold. And everyone's, you know, that like basically said to me as a young kid, you know, everyone who pretends they know what the fuck they're talking about is just winging it all at the same time, right? So that opened up a ton of thought processes to go down in all facets of life, right? Yep. And then Snowden happened. And at that point I was like, fuck, we can't trust American companies, mm-hmm. right? At that point, I thought, you know, I already had a fuck the man kind of attitude, but I was like, even if the U.S. government's spying on me, like I was, you know, I was a Google fanboy. Like Google, yep. Google will protect us, you know. And
what was it? Don't be evil.
Yeah, don't. They won't be evil. They told us they're not going to be evil. We're going to be good. You'll just use the built-in security settings or whatever Google gives you. And then I discovered Bitcoin, and I was like, okay, this is pretty awesome. It kind of combined all those things together into one. But I thought they would squash it, you know. I thought they would. I thought the response was going to be way more aggressive than it ended up being.
Okay.
And I thought it was going to be easier to squash than it ended up being. So when I had that realization, when I was like, "Oh shit, they're going to have to do a lot more than I thought," I was like, "Okay, I'm in. This All right. is it."
And so was there one moment where that switch happened from like, oh, this is cool, but unlikely to be successful, to like, I'm in? Or was it more of a gradual kind of like, you're gaining confidence in the fact that this is going to survive?
So the other thing that happened was you had the online gambling ban in America, right? I may or may not like to gamble. So I actually, the first thing that clicked for me was, even if it's just used by Americans to gamble online, yep. it should be, you know, moderately successful. Right, so I thought that was like a good bridging point. Yep. You know, at that point, I wasn't, you know, saying, "Oh, like this is going to be the global reserve currency of the world." Like, yeah, we've come a long way since then.
So you go from maybe but unlikely to like, "Oh, this thing's not going to go away." To before we get into some of the nuances, like, where are you today when you think of Bitcoin? Like, what is it to you? And then where do you think we're going? Like how big can it get? Is it global reserve currency at some point in the future? Like, where's your kind of vision of the future?
I think Bitcoin is the best money we've ever had. I think Bitcoin is like essentially like a global escape hatch. It allows us to, as individuals, to voluntarily opt out of a basically a shitty hand that young people have been given. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sent my first Bitcoin transaction before I ever sent a bank wire, right? And now I send bank wires and I look over it like 25 times. You know, like Marty always says, like, "Oh, I'm still double checking my addresses. I always get worried when I send Bitcoin." Like, to this day, I get worried when I send a wire. Like, because even if there's like ways to reverse it, like, who wants to spend hours on phone trying to figure out where the money went and where what happened? So I immediately see that change in friction, that yeah. whole thing is digitally native. And to me, like, I have real money, and then like I have US dollars. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, I have fully made that transition in my head with my own mental, mm-hmm. It feels more tangible to me, even though there's no physical thing to hold in your hand. It feels so much more tangible. It's like really hard to put my finger on that feeling, but it definitely exists. And I think that anyone who's a Bitcoiner feels that. And then at this point, like, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I think that it could be the global reserve currency. Mm-hmm. We're sitting on that. But even if it's like magnitudes less, like, it's still yeah. going to pump a shit ton, right? Yeah. So I just...
The thing to me, when I first, like, really it hit me, like, wow, this is different and this is better. It's like... Everything about Bitcoin that I think people who believe in Bitcoin usually tell folks is so theoretical and so like sophisticated around sound money and inflation. It's like these really complex topics. So you've got to start with like, what is inflation? How does that debase a currency? What are the problems with that? Like, all of that to explain like sound money is important, right? But the most practical thing that I ever experienced was I forget where I went, but I was in the airport and I was about to leave and I had to change money, right? So I had to change from US dollars to, I literally think I was in Korea, right? And I'm just thinking like, how stupid is this? Like, literally, they won't accept the money that is accepted somewhere right. else because it's just, you know, a different piece of paper, right? Right? Or whatever. And to me, that was when I was just like, we should probably have a universal global money, right? Right? And so like, yeah, technically like your credit card acts that way, even though it's not money, it's credit.
Kind of, yeah.
But that's when I started to realize like, oh, it's not just like sound money and the more complex like structural things. Like, there's very specific practical, you know, use cases or practical examples of where Bitcoin is better than fiat currencies. It's just going to take a really, really long time, because if you start with, just take that example, how many people actually exchange money every year when they travel? Like, right. That's a small part of the population, right?
And well, over most time, people don't even travel with cash anymore.
Well, a whole other thing.
They just skipped it and went to credit cards.
And
but then your credit card gets canceled. You have no money.
Have you ever called for the longest time? I would call the credit card company, and be like, "Hey, just so you know, like I'm going to X country. Like, don't shut it off." Right. Basically,
please don't shut it off on me.
And then, like recently, over the last, I don't know, maybe a year or so, now they say you don't have to call us.
Right.
And I still like want to call because I feel like no, I want you to want me to call you when I travel. Like, you shouldn't be approving.
I wonder if that's because they know they're like tracking whether or not you bought plane tickets, stuff like that.
Good point.
Like, I never called my American Express, but I buy my plane tickets with my American Express.
So
I'm like, here, guys, just so you know, I don't feel like calling you, but
yeah.
You know.
All right, so that leads me to I just want people to understand where you're coming from a Bitcoin perspective. There's a bunch of topics I want to talk to you about. The one that you've recently been talking a ton about, which I'm like almost 100% in agreement with you, and I think that you could go stand on top of the Empire State Building, scream till you're blue in the face about, and nobody will care because they don't think about the second and third order effects, is this idea of like KYC can be dangerous. And so just explain like what you mean by that, and then we'll get into some of the nuances of it.
Well, so KYC is they're essentially aggregating all of your important data all in a central database that either they can use or it could get leaked. They could, you know, get hacked and they can lose it. So like you trust them in two regards when they take your KYC data, your know your customer data. You're trusting them to use it properly, whatever that is. And then you're also trusting them not to fucking lose it, and they constantly lose it. We see it all the time. We just had the Capital One hack.
100 million people.
Right, and in that case, so people didn't even realize you were trusting Capital One, but you're also trusting Amazon because Capital One was storing on Amazon servers, mm-hmm. and then it was an Amazon employee, mm-hmm. right? You know, Amazon runs the internet, basically. Like AWS, everyone uses AWS. An Amazon employee was the one who compromised the data and took it. And Capital One didn't even know the data was taken until someone saw it, put two and two together, and told them.
So to clarify, I believe what happened is it's an Amazon employee who left the company, but during the employment, like figured out some vulnerability and then went, got the data. And I read an article and it looked like they were almost like not being malicious, but also they knew that they were breaking the law. Like it was almost like this weird, like, oh, here I'm like uploading this to this chat because I don't want it to be on my computer. So like they knew it was bad, but they weren't trying to monetize,
right?
Yeah, they she wasn't trying to sell it. She wasn't trying to like do anything with
it. She just wanted to leak 150 million.
I don't even think that she was trying to leak it. Like what it looked like to me was more like at least from the article it appeared like she was more like it was an engineering exercise of like, hey, I can get this, and then she had written code and like stored it on GitHub, which literally had like a IP address or something like something that pointed to that database of where she got the data from, and that's how they ended up putting it together, because somebody saw the GitHub code and then literally was like, they sent an email to Capital One. It was like, hey, by the way, I think somebody has your data.
Because they're selling it. Yeah, exactly. But she wasn't selling it.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Well, who knows?
But anyway, that's all moot, right?
Yep.
The point is they collect all this information. They know your address. They know your phone number. They know your email address. Pretty much no one ever changes their phone number anymore. So that's like a very big identifier. Then they know your social security number, which people still pretend is like private information. You can open like bank accounts in people's names and take out mortgages. I don't know. You could do tons of shit with the social security number. So like all your private information. Then if it's a company like Capital One, they know all of your payments. They know your full payment history. They know bank accounts. They know all that stuff. So when all that data is combined, it's very easily for it to be used against you. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of and especially like imagine. So now we're talking about KYC. Imagine it's a Bitcoin service. Mm-hmm. They know how much Bitcoin you own. They know where your transactions are going. They know. Exactly. Those two key things, and then you mix that with all their personal identifiable information, and they know where you live, they know who your family is. Like, that gets really fucking scary really fucking quick.
So I agree that handing your data over to any company or organization that has some sort of security vulnerabilities is a huge risk, right? And we've seen, I think it was Marty Bent in his newsletter either today or yesterday, was like, we've seen again and again and again and again. And he hyperlinked out to like, and each one of them is not like, you know, hey, somebody stole five records. It's like they stole like 50 million people's personal information, right?
Right.
So you've literally probably the odds have to be like, you know, your information has been stolen 30 or 40 times at this point. It's not just, you know, one person got it.
Well, the Equifax one was really bad. That was just like every adult American, just all the information.
Well, and so like the opposite argument, right? Like if I play devil's advocate, if you were talking to a regulator, for example, like, well, we need KYC to prevent money laundering. We need KYC right. to protect markets, like all this stuff. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt that their argument has some level of validity, right? We can argue over how important it is, whatever, but let's just say that's true. How do you thread the needle between those two arguments, right? So like, giving my data is a huge vulnerability for me and a huge security risk because now somebody else is in control of it, they get hacked, et cetera. But there's this society that I've agreed to live in, and there's some social contracts that are involved in that that say that the information is necessary to, quote unquote, protect the system or protect me, whatever. Where do you think like the common ground is, or like what's the solution to that trade-off?
I think that to use the traditional finance system, you have to submit to all of this information. It's by design. It's how they set up the whole fraud system. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they would get screwed. There'd be no way for them to basically collect their debts.
Yep.
With Bitcoin, it's unnecessary.
Okay,
that's one of the groundbreaking things about Bitcoin, because it's a push system. It's completely unnecessary. Like BitMEX, you know, makes millions of dollars every year. And they never, no one ever, you know, defrauds them. No one ever steals money from them mm-hmm. because it uses a Bitcoin system. They don't have to know anything about their customers. Mm-hmm. So as far as I'm concerned with KYC, is if you're an on-ramp, I reluctantly accept it. Because, or an on-ramp or an off-ramp, there's no way, it's very difficult to get in and out there unless there's some kind of person-to-person element, like BISC, where someone's sending it to you from their bank account directly to the buyer directly to the seller, or something like local Bitcoins, you know, stuff like that where you have person to person. But if it's any kind of regulated on-ramp, like we're going to have to deal with KYC. There's no excuse for a Bitcoin company that isn't an on-ramp mm-hmm. to be dealing with KYC. And oftentimes the excuse is, well, you know, we have to connect to fiat and stuff. Well, you shouldn't do that. You don't connect to fiat, right? Like, look at BitMEX. BitMEX has no fiat connection whatsoever.
So your argument is there's two separate systems, right? They're alternatives to each other. There's the fiat system, there's the crypto system. In companies where there is a bridge, naturally the fiat system is going to require the KYC.
Right.
But you're actually making the argument that in the crypto only world, so if you're going crypto to crypto, if you're just using Bitcoin, et cetera, within a system, because there is no bridge back to that fiat system, that KYC isn't necessary, shouldn't be done, et cetera. Like that's a very nuanced argument versus
compared BitMEX versus Coinbase or whatever.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Or
the on-ramp is actually where the KYC has a place,
right.
But if you don't have that on-ramp, then that's where your analysis of KYC completely changes.
The on-ramp or off-ramp, yep. Right? This is like one of the issues as well, like things like all the Bitcoin credit cards, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're like spending and it automatically converts to fiat.
Yep.
They have to do full KYC.
Yep. See, like I actually think that argument is much stronger than, hey, there should be no KYC ever, right?
Right.
Like just kind of blanket, whether it's fiat or crypto, there should be no KYC. It's going to be hard to convince a lot of people to get behind that. Right. And then the argument of like there should be full KYC on both the fiat and crypto world, regardless of if there's on-ramps, off-ramps, I think that's pretty hard to get people around as well.
Right.
And so the nuance of KYC in the fiat world, not needed in the crypto world, but if there's a link on an on or off-ramp, then you have it as well. Like that seems pretty reasonable to me.
I think I don't think KYC is effective at all at stopping money laundering. I think we have tons of money laundering, and it's not the types of people that would get deterred by KYC on their.
We were going to get to this point. Go ahead.
But that's besides the point. I mean, the whole idea, the whole Cypherpunk manifesto, like the whole idea is that we do what we can, right? You run code and you try and create tools to circumvent that. And that is like a tangible goal. Like we can have all Bitcoin only businesses can never do KYC and we'd be good. But you have to follow like certain principles. And this is part of the reason why I was like freaking out during 2017 is like everyone completely lost the plot, because it goes farther. Like I simplified it by saying fiat on ramps and off ramps. Mm-hmm. Like if your service is domiciled in America, is based in America, you have American founders that are known, mm-hmm. You have major investors all investing in it, like your business is going to have to do KYC as well. Yeah. And I think the whole value prop here is circumventing that friction, circumventing KYC and censorship resistance. So if you don't have that, it's worthless. Whatever that is worthless. Mm-hmm. And I see, and that's one of the big critiques I throw at Ethereum all the time, is that I think like a lot of their so-called dApps, like they think of all these technical reasons why that they're censorship resistant, mm-hmm. but the main issue they have is actually the people issue. Mm-hmm. You know, who's behind it, their known actors, all this mm-hmm. stuff. Like I want to see more like anonymous Bitcoin companies with dope products.
Yeah, so like I don't even think you're using the word circumvent, but like I don't even think it's circumventing, right? Because what you're really doing is you're saying it's very similar to like, hey, today we signed contracts on a piece of paper, then all of a sudden somebody invents like electronic signatures. Like you didn't circumvent the paper, you just created a better way, right? Like that's essentially what you're talking about here, is you're not circumventing the rules of the law as in like a we want to break the law. What you're doing is you're creating a better system that actually should be more compliant. Like the thing I keep going back to is Bitcoin transactions are immutable when they're put on the chain, right? And so if you're a money launderer today and you're using all the different methods you have available, you want to use cash because it's not traceable.
Right, but they want to ban cash too.
So the logic, if that follows, is if there's a system that's writing down every transaction, right? It's pseudonymous, so it's not like, you know, the police can just go search Matt O'Dell and figure out that Matt O'Dell did this transaction.
Right.
But what they can see is the wallet-to-wallet transactions, etc. And so if they deem somebody did something illegal, it is actually, you know, I had a DEA agent come on and he's just like, look, it's easier to track here than it is cash. Of course.
Right.
Right?
But I mean, I think that's kind of an issue, but.
Okay, so I want to get in because I know that as part of this KYC thing, privacy, right, so things like Samurai Wallet, etc., people are working to take the pseudonymity of Bitcoin and turn it into a much more private type transactions. I don't think we're there. We're not there, right? But the work that's going on, moving us in that direction, I think can have a lot of advantages. From your perspective, how do we kind of settle on KYC, privacy, the pseudonymity, but also not changing the core benefits or the core criteria and aspects of Bitcoin itself?
Well, so to connect those two things together, like one of the major issues we have with KYC is that Bitcoin is a transparent ledger, mm-hmm. Which is pretty immutable. It's going to last for a long, long time. And by mixing those KYC, that KYC information, they can then follow you through the chain, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
All the transactions you do after that. And that doesn't just de-anonymize you. It also reduces the anonymity set of everyone else that you ever interact with, mm-hmm. right? So like imagine in the most simplest way, like imagine your boss pays you, your boss pays your salary, right? Mm-hmm. And then you buy a cup of coffee somewhere, the famous coffee that everyone's buying with Bitcoin. The barista shouldn't know what your salary is, right? You pay rent, you know, your landlord shouldn't know you lost $200 in poker yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so
there's some default privacy that you should be afforded without having to compromise that just because you want to use a certain asset.
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of this gets stuck in the weeds about all these theoreticals and people are shouting at each other and it gets very intense. But I think at the end of the day, what everyone wants is the ability. This is why I like distilling it. I think what everyone wants is the ability to receive a payment from someone or pay someone with the expectation that all your future and past transactions aren't completely visible to them. Right? There should at least be some level of plausible deniability there.
I think that's a perfect way to put it.
Right. And I think people are leaking way more information than they realize. And it's not just on Bitcoin. It's across all of these networks. I mean, it's across non-crypto networks. Like, a lot of people don't even realize that they're leaking all their Venmo. All their Venmo transactions are being publicly broadcast.
My favorite part about Venmo is they put a social feed and people go on and just read through the feed.
Who does that? I don't even...
All right. So that's on the KYC, the privacy side. I want to talk about tangentially related to privacy is talk a lot about Wasabi, about Samurai, right? All these tools that are being built around privacy. What is your kind of best practice for somebody when they go to send a transaction and they don't want to expose the data, et cetera? Are there a couple of data points that you're just like, look, you should be doing A, B, and C. You can use a bunch of different service providers to do it or different tools, but like these are the key components to like protecting your privacy while using Bitcoin?
So KYC, once again, just to go back, makes all of this so much more difficult, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you bought Bitcoin from like a cash seller, and the only person who can follow that trail is the cash seller, and he's not keeping track of anything, right?
Or if you mined, right?
Right. Mining is the best. Mining is always the best. You just it's permissionless. You can plug in a miner. You just convert your electricity into Bitcoin.
Virgin Bitcoin for the moment.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a term that'll stick around, but
no, I mean I don't think that Bitcoin should have any more value than any other Bitcoin. If it does, then we've failed. But it is the best way to get Bitcoin to private if you care about privacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you mine Bitcoin, right? Now it's sitting in my wallet, and I want to send the Bitcoin to you.
Yeah.
What are those steps that you think?
The best tool we have is CoinJoins, and you can either use Wasabi or Samurai. Mm-hmm. I think Wasabi is a little bit more fleshed out right now. Mm-hmm. There's still a bunch of UX issues. It's a wallet that you run on your computer. You send Bitcoin to it, and then it mixes it with other people's Bitcoin to basically give you plausible deniability. Mm-hmm. Let's say I mix it with 50 people or whatever, it gives you, it's all of a sudden the transactions could have went one in 50 different ways. And if you keep repeating that process, you get increased levels of plausible deniability. So then at the end, if I give you, you know, a UTXO with Bitcoin in it, it'll be hard to see, if not impossible to see where it comes from. But the thing is, the way Bitcoin is set up currently and the way, because these tools are so new, there's a lot of places where you can fuck that up. So I think the most important thing for people to realize is that Bitcoin isn't anonymous, that most of these networks aren't anonymous. Like the only privacy coin that's even vaguely interesting is Monero to me. But like no matter what, like you should just assume the key is to realize how much data you're leaking. That's the first step to take. And then start trying to take steps into your own hands into learning how these tools work and trying to use them effectively. You know, Samurai their plan is that they're just going to have an app on your phone. They're going to have a node in a box with the Noddle guys. I really like the Noddle guys. You buy the node, $400. You plug it in at home. You connect it to the internet. It syncs up. Now you got a full node. Then you can pair it with your phone by just scanning a QR code, right? Mm-hmm. And then from that point on, you're using your full node, and you can just mix right on your phone. Just click a button. It should be a lot easier. And then the key here is after the coin joins, where a lot of people screw up is spending them afterwards. And if you mix certain outputs, especially outputs that are still linked to your KYC information, still linked to you, then they can
track it.
People can track it. So Samurai wants to make that post-spend simpler. I'm hoping Wasabi does the same. And to people who say like, oh, well, that's like, it's crazy, like expecting people to spend $400 on a note. You can have a situation there where like 15, 20 of your closest friends are all using the same back end.
Skirt, skirt. Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal. Mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at crypto.com. Go help your boy out. Tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit crypto.com. Pomp's got you always. Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi.
All you got to do is go to coinmine.com. You buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right. You purchase it. It shows up at your doorstep. You pull it out of the box. You plug it in, connect to your Wi-Fi. 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp sent you, and thank me later.
So I've heard two arguments, right? When we go and talk to investors, I bring up CoinJoin quite often as a way to, like, there's technologies that are being built, right? They're very early, but there's encouraging signs there. And I get one of two reactions. The negative reaction is, so wait a minute, I'm going to put my money into a pot. That pot is literally going to get mixed up or laundered, right? And then it's going to come out the other end magically to somebody. Right. That sounds like money laundering.
Right.
It's kind of the hyper negative response. The positive response is, if I take a dollar bill out of my pocket right now and I go and I deposit it in a bank, right, that dollar goes into the bank along with all the other dollars. And if you then go and I tell the bank, send it to you, and you go and you pull a dollar out from your bank, it's not the same dollar, right? So there's a kind of you put your $1 into this pot of other dollars, right? Yeah. And then you're getting a transaction on the other side and pulling it out into a different dollar, right? That the fungibility is different than with Bitcoin. Where do you think the technology can evolve without regulators coming down and saying this is illegal, right? Like that's where I always go to, is just as regulators kind of clamp down more and more on this stuff, they're going to go to like the privacy technology, right? Kind of like the argument against encryption in the 90s was like, well, if you have nothing to hide, why do you need encryption?
Right. That's what they always go for. That's what they always do.
Well, I can tell you a lot of reasons why. And by the way, you know, 25 years later, it's the standard now.
But they're still doing it, right? Like the AG just said that he wanted a backdoor to encryption.
Crazy. So where do you think that we can get on privacy? Do you think we can get to full private Bitcoin transactions? Or do you think that there's some roadblocks there that are going to make that difficult?
I mean, it really just matters how regulators respond. Mm-hmm. I think that they've already responded way better by basically not responding than mm-hmm. I expected. Mm-hmm. I thought Bitcoin, you know, part of the reason, like, the whole concept of HODL, like, really resonated with me was because I was genuinely afraid that if you tried to time the market in 2015 or 2016 or whatever and sold something, like, you wouldn't be able to get back in. Like, America would ban it, and then it would pump everywhere else, and I'd be like, oh my God, I can't. Like, that would be like worst case. For me, that would be worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. So I think, but you still should, don't be that cocky. Like, the goal here should be to try and accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible. Your government, whether that's America or somewhere else, may very likely ban it. They may very likely ban self-custody. They may very likely ban CoinJoin usage. Try and take the proper precautions now. Try to leak as little data as possible. Try not to connect your known identity to Bitcoin, so you're more resistant in those situations. Like, we're very much fucked in that regard. But
our names and faces are everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
They got us already.
But like, that's the number one thing you can do. I mean, if you find a place where you can buy without KYC, and you can just like hide in the shadows, and because I don't think any of this kills Bitcoin. I think it just delays it and it fucks over the citizens of whatever country it's in. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that's what people say. Like, oh, like CoinJoin's great enough. Like, I love CoinJoin. If America just said CoinJoins are illegal, then anyone who sent, like, anyone who drew from Cash App or something and then sent it to a CoinJoin, it's pretty obvious. You go went into a CoinJoin, they just close your account, right? Mm-hmm. That's that. You can't use those fiat on ramps with CoinJoin. Right now, they're not doing that. So what does that say to me? That says to me you should CoinJoin as much as possible right now, just in case, because mm-hmm. it isn't illegal. It's using Bitcoin privately. Like, it's a new tool to use Bitcoin privately. It's like saying that like Signal is used for drug dealers, right? It's like the same exact thing.
Yeah. The thing also to me, we touched on a little bit, is the idea of mining, right? Like the creation, right? Or the distribution of an asset in the fiat world. the only way to get dollars is all coming through KYC'd or you know, related avenues. Like, right. You can't go in your house and just be like, hey, let me create some coins, right? Like physical coins, or let me create a dollar.
Right.
You get in trouble for that, right? Whereas in Bitcoin, you can. And so there's some dynamics that change, right? At least for, I don't know, next, you know, 100, 120 years, whatever it is. I don't think that regulators or even users yet understand the impact of that, right? Like, the idea that you can actually go and produce it yourself with the electricity in your home or somewhere else, it's like you having a printing press, right? But it's you're participating as part of the system, and the entire network of those printing presses are governed by the same algorithm or software.
I mean, first of all, I think everyone that's obsessed with blockchain, like, the real innovation is distributed proof of work. That's okay. The innovation.
Explain what you mean by distributed proof of work.
Bitcoin mining, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, we have miners around the world that are mining. They're getting paid by the network for work they provide. It's basically a free market price for energy. And no one can stop those individual miners. Like, you don't... The existing miners can't be like, well, that new hardware that plugged in isn't getting paid from the network, mm-hmm. right? It's just a fundamentally different change than having like a setup like a Ripple or something, where you have known validators that are basically acting in like a semi-trusted setup.
Real quick, Russell Kong, I saw you come in and say what's up. We got to give you a shout out. Russell Okung is an NFL player and a Pro Bowler who absolutely has taken the world by storm by bringing Bitcoin to a group of people that, frankly, nobody in crypto or Bitcoin could do themselves. So big shout out to you, man.
What's up, Russ?
All right, let's go back to this idea of the distributed proof of work, because I think that not only is it a technical advancement, right? And we've seen it grow and be adopted and kind of gain the strength that it has, right? It's the strongest computing network in the world. It has impact on the regulation, right? You saw a congressman recently, he's like, we cannot stop this, right? We cannot kill it. Everyone who's tried has failed. And therefore, rather than trying to kill it, we should embrace it and we should encourage innovation. We should get people to come here, etc. 100% confident it can't be killed, 90%, what do you think the risks are to proof of work or just Bitcoin in general?
Well, I think in general, the cat's out of the fucking bag.
Okay, meaning Bitcoin, proof of work, both?
Yeah, just everything. Cryptocurrencies, yep. Using distributed proof of work.
Yep.
I think it will be Bitcoin. I think that it'll be really hard for them to destroy credibility in basically the UTXO set, which is the most fair ledger that I think has ever existed, because you can never replicate, my co-host on TFTC, Marty, likes talking about it, the Immaculate Conception. You can never replicate. So even if, like, for some reason, you know, the Bitcoin network failed, I think whatever advantages, like whatever we've learned from that situation will, like, continue on from the UTXO set, right? Mm-hmm. The most recent agreed upon UTXO set. But I mean, I just think that it's like Bitcoin is more than just code, right? It's like all the people that believe in it and all the people that put money into it and have faith in it. And I think the genie's out of the bottle. Like, I don't, and first of all, anyone can spin up a new proof of work currency anonymously. Like, this is where we go back. Like, that's why I think, like, the whole ICOs with pre-mines and advisors on the paper, all these guys are located in Palo Alto and shit. Like, it was a perversion of the whole idea that, like, at least, like, the original shit coins, like, they were just some rando on, you know, online that was just posting an announcement thread, like, I'm releasing this new coin, and no one knew who he was. There was no, because when you start talking about storing billions, trillions of dollars on these things, like, it's going to get a lot more There's things there that become worth it because there's so much money on the line for nation states and wealthy individuals, you know, like stuff like missile strikes and EMPs and shutting down internet in large swaths of the country. Mm-hmm. Like, you can do some crazy things once if it becomes this global financial system.
The power went out in like a section of Manhattan and people were ready to kill each other.
They handled it pretty well, all things considered. Yeah,
they really did, but it was it was weird walking around and you could just feel energy in the air. So one of the things that I've been thinking more and more about is I don't think that there is a single company that raised $0 and has reached $200+ billion in market cap. Right, like every company took money at some point somewhere. Maybe they went a while without it, but eventually they had to raise money. Bitcoin's not a company, but it is a network that we ascribe value to by the US dollar exchange price. It is absolutely insane that this happened. Right, like to get to the point that we are in 10 and a half years where you have the president, the treasury secretary, Congress, Senate, they're all talking about it, the G7, the central banks, etc. And it came from somebody who is pseudonymous, who we don't think was very well connected. You know, it's not like some, you know, rich billionaire who did it.
Could have been.
It could have been, but just the way that it was put into the world at least wasn't like, hey, let me go get me and all my friends to you know, put a bunch of money behind this. It doesn't appear there wasn't any investment, right? And it is probably one of the most naturally adopted technology products the world's ever seen.
Okay.
Right? No marketing campaigns, no anything. Going back to your idea of like this immaculate conception, right, that Marty talks about a lot, I don't think it can be replicated. Like I literally do not think you can replicate it at this point because there's too much attention.
Right. It was like it got to grow up in this nice little vacuum chamber where no one was poking it and prodding it and trying to fuck with it. And
what a lot of people don't realize, like you said it earlier, right? You are probably one of the most outspoken Bitcoin proponents, meaning that not in like a negative or a critical way, but meaning that you are, here's what I believe and I'm willing to say it publicly, etc. Right?
Well, you said that. I didn't say that.
I'm saying that. I'm claiming that for him. The part that always shocks me when I talk to you and others like you, right? Most of them start out skeptical, right? It wasn't just like, oh, I saw it and like I knew, right?
That'd be ridiculous.
Of course. So like, but what I think when people come in today, what they just see is like, oh my God, who are these crazy people who just like believe this thing? And you're like, you know, in your case, you're like, dude, 7 years, right? Of, and like the first two or three, like I didn't necessarily think it was real, right? Even if you talk to like Safe Dean and others, they're like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years of being skeptical or being highly, highly cautious, but yet optimistic.
And hearing the same, keep in mind, like, hearing the same skeptical claims over and over again, mm-hmm. that we've refuted in our own heads, we've refuted on Twitter, we've refuted across a bunch of different mediums, but it just keeps getting replayed over and over again. It's like the same, it's similar FUD lines.
I don't know if you've seen Barry Silbert's been like screwing around with the CNBC host, and he keeps tweeting out like, you know, there's five levels.
Who, Joe?
Well, Joe's the example that he used at first. Now he's doing it with like Andrew and Melissa, et cetera, where he's like, you know, level one is basically you don't even know about Bitcoin. Level two, you believe or whatever it is. And like level five means like you're like a shill, right?
Like full Joe level. Joe,
yeah,
Joe
yeah, level. Like full on Bitcoin, you know, promoter. There's also that for the like haters, right? Like if somebody tweets at you on Twitter and they're like trying to troll or saying something negative, you can almost back into like, ah, they've probably been around for like 6 months, right? Because the sophistication of their argument against Bitcoin starts out really dumb. Right, like, oh, you guys are crazy. You can't replace money.
Right.
Then it goes to like, oh, it's slow. The transactions don't work. Then it's like, oh, not only is it slow, nobody uses it. Right. And it's kind of like there's this graduation. And the part to me that's interesting is like you eventually get to like the level five of the non-believers, and then they fall over, and then they start believing. Right. And you've seen this with everyone from economists to guys like Joe on
well, some
TV,
people
et
just dig their feet in because they regret it. They regret it forever, and they'll be forever salty.
Yesterday when I did Peter Schiff's the debate with him, at one point in the conversation I asked him why not, you know, participate now, right? And he said something to me that just – I literally almost fell out of my chair. He's like, because it's over. I missed it.
Right. Everyone thinks they're late when they come in. I thought I was late as fuck when I got in. Like I was like, oh, I could have bought Bitcoin at 30 cents, $2, $3. Like If I was then, I would have bought so much.
Trace Meyer was writing, Run. I think it's called Run to Gold. It was like a gold bug newsletter back in 2010, 2011. And Safe Dean has publicly said that's how he learned about Bitcoin originally, was he was reading Trace. And Trace was writing at the time that he missed it. And it was like $2, right? Like,
everyone thinks they're late.
It's incredible because you hear it in 2019, the same things that were happening in 2010. I'm willing to bet in, you know, $50,000 Bitcoin, $100,000 Bitcoin, they're all going to say the exact same thing. But the
I thought 10,000, when people were making the 10,000 claims, I thought fucking out of their mind. And I was bullish as fuck, you know, but it's still 10,000 was like a moon number for me. And like, I actually talked to Pierre about this. Like, me and him were like super during the 2017 run.
Yep.
We were super reasonable, like up to 10K. We're telling people like, dollar cost average, like don't put in more than you can afford to lose, like blah blah blah. And then like the second it passed 10K, we were like, hyper Bitcoinization is coming out, it's happening quicker than any of us expected. We have no, it's like the moon is
18
so far.
Days, 10K to 20K.
Yeah.
Which
that was insane. That was absolutely insane.
So here's what scares me is, let's say that type of cycle repeats. Is the next, you know, move, is it like 150 to 300,000 in, you know, 20 days? Like, I meant like the numbers of just doubling, right? Right. So forget it, 10 to 20. It's just if there's a doubling that happens right at the top of a bull market before it kind of turns over into a bear market, the numbers may literally be like it goes up $10,000 in a day.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfathomable. I can't comprehend it, so I don't try. Right, like that's the beauty of stacking sats. Like you just keep dollar cost averaging once a week. You know, every two all weeks, right. Every month, whatever it is, don't look at the price, just money you can afford to lose, and it should go up. Like, that's the theory. It's not a very complicated, simple.
You said stacking sats, and I want you to explain what it is, but just explain what it is, and I'm going to tell a story real quick that cracks me up to this day. But what exactly do you mean by stacking sats?
Dollar cost averaging with money you're willing to lose that you can live without. Like, not, you know, with money that you can live without. On a reoccurring basis without caring about price, and then taking custody of it and making sure that, you know, you have control of it. No one can take that Bitcoin from you.
All right. So you and Marty were the first two people I ever heard say stacking sats. And when I saw it, I was like, that is genius. Like, it just, it makes sense. It's catchy. Like, people are going to love that, right? And it took off. And I'm not sure exactly where it came from. I think I've seen now you said that you guys didn't even come up with it.
Well, someone tweeted it in 2017.
Okay.
It had like no engagement. Yep. He like disappeared in the like, and
he's right, one of the smart ones.
The bear market happened. He was gone. This is just 2017. I think I heard it before that.
Yep.
It's a really nice alliteration.
Yep.
But like, I popularized on Twitter. Like, I created the hashtag.
Yep.
And I just, we shilled the shit out of it and just constantly.
She just kept tweeting it. And then it somehow got associated with Cash App because you guys were talking much about Cash App.
Yeah.
And so one day I remember I tweeted at you and I was like, that's like a genius marketing campaign. Like, you know, like you guys will never get credit for like creating that, but like, that's awesome. And I was telling my partner Jason the other day, I said, and then you came in and you like
dunked on
360,
you so
like reverse windmill between the legs, stick my elbow in the rim, dunked on me in the comments. It was like, it's not a marketing campaign, it's a lifestyle.
No, it's not crypto, it's Bitcoin. It's not a marketing campaign, it's a lifestyle.
Oh, that's right, I said, that's the best crypto marketing campaign. And you were like, it's not crypto, it's Bitcoin. It's not a marketing campaign, it's a lifestyle.
I felt bad about that dunk, by the
way. Well, you shouldn't, because
you teed me up. But I felt bad.
I've never told the other side of it is when you tweeted that and I was sitting there and I read it, I literally died laughing and I said to myself, he wins this one. I'm just not even going to say anything, like he wins.
Marty texted me afterwards. He was like, Pomp is just being nice, dude. I was like, I appreciate that, but he shouldn't have said crypto and marketing campaign.
Listen, the other thing we should talk about with Bitcoin that is this whole like, oh, it's a toxic community. The one thing that I can say,
we're not toxic.
Well, here's what I will say is, this is coming from somebody who's been on both sides of correcting people and absolutely getting fucking destroyed on Twitter at times, right? Is the Bitcoin community understands probably better than you would ever think they do. There is nobody to protect this other than us, meaning the community, right? There's no company, there's no marketing, there's no PR, there's nothing there other than the people who believe in Bitcoin and use Bitcoin. and they take that shit seriously, right? And so when they see people saying, like, you know, the Narelle Rabinis and all those types of guys are really easy because they're just being so ridiculous, right, that, you know, people just tee off on them. But even inside their own community, like, how many people are considered in with the Bitcoin community? And it's not that people turn on them as much as just like, it's like, hey, man, like, you stepped out of line, right? Or hey, walk that back, right? And I think that that is drastically underestimated, and it gets labeled as like, oh, it's toxic, it's this, it's that. It's essential, right, in order for this to be successful, because if not, then the detractors, the media, et cetera, will all control the narrative. And I think that's really, really harmful to Bitcoin for all the new people who have to come in.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's plenty of toxic shit in this space. I think there's plenty of toxic shit in the world. But I don't think it's like Bitcoiners are more toxic than the average.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Bitcoiners are very educated. They're very defensive. They see through bullshit. You know, we've been fed so much fucking bullshit over and over again that sometimes we can be a little bit cranky about it. But the thought is in the right place. Like, first of all, I don't think that Bitcoin needs us, you know, trolling shitcoiners mm-hmm. on Twitter for Bitcoin to succeed. Like, mm-hmm. all shitcoins are going to trend to zero in Bitcoin terms.
You think everyone goes to zero?
In Bitcoin terms.
Okay. All right.
Along with every other asset on Earth. Okay. Right? Like, I think that Bitcoin is designed to essentially pump forever, and all this stuff is going to trend to zero. They can't keep... Like you interviewed, like, the guy who did the Monarch token.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Like, the question to ask him, besides all the Roger Ver apologizing that he did, is what are the trade-offs? Why would someone ever hold Monarch token mm-hmm. when they could hold Bitcoin? Mm-hmm. There's no reason to. If you can easily move in between the two, why would you ever hold it?
All right. So this is a good conversation, because I'm going to take devil's advocate. Things that I'm about to say, I don't necessarily believe. Right? So I'll caveat all this. But I believe that some portion of the people with utility tokens, right? So not everyone, but some portion of people who have, and not even utility tokens, just non-Bitcoin tokens, would say, my token is used to make transactions, and the lack of volatility is really important. So whether it's a stable coin or it's some other coin, this was purpose-built for this use case, which is one of Bitcoin's least valuable use cases, and therefore, in this one use case, this token is better than Bitcoin. Response.
So I want to delineate here between security tokens and utility tokens.
Okay.
Okay. Security tokens, if you have like a partial ownership of the company, mm-hmm. while not censorship resistant, mm-hmm. and probably comes with KYC as per our previous conversation.
For sure. Yep. By the nature of being a security, it will have to.
Right. Yep. And known actors and yep. all these different accountability measures to yep. actually ensure that you're getting any kind of equity, right? Could have some value. Mm-hmm. But like you should just use money. Like, don't make up fake money that no one's going to want to hold for your product. Like, all these things can be used with, you know, Bitcoin.
Your argument is basically that for the purposes of a store of value or a medium of exchange, Bitcoin is the best as a holistic solution, and therefore use what is the best rather than try to create something that has one single use case and you think can compete on this one thing, because ultimately the thing that's the best is going to be the best in everything.
Bitcoin is a utility token as well, mm-hmm. right? Because it's paying the miners. Mm-hmm. Like, it provides a very distinct utility of paying the miners and for the fees. Mm-hmm. But it's developed this monetary premium. It has this store value quality mm-hmm. to it. The question to me become, all of these pre-mines and ICOs and tokens are short-term thinking. It's a way for the founders to get rich really quick, dumping this coin onto retail and also pre-dumping it onto hedge funds who then dump it onto retail or whatever.
Pre-dumping it on the hedge funds. Like,
but they also get a dump out of it too. Yeah. So, but anyway, long-term, whatever chain is successful, which I think is Bitcoin, mm-hmm. is everyone is going to, whatever their project is, they're going to want to operate as frictionless, with the least amount of friction mm-hmm. between them and Bitcoin.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The projects that don't, will have a disadvantage compared to the projects that do.
Okay.
But then the projects that do, mm-hmm. there's no reason to hold their token if you can easily move in and out of it for whatever the specific utility is.
Okay. So
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah. So I am also of the belief, which I think you're going to agree with, is a lot of times people talk about all the things that can be built on top of blockchains, et cetera. So take the security, like the highly regulated, we're going to basically digitize an asset, right? So take all that out for a second. Building on top of any of these chains, the way that I conceptualize it is like there's a spectrum. So you have security and then you have like innovation on the other end, right? And the farther you move towards innovation, the less security you get.
The more centralized, basically.
It doesn't necessarily – well, yeah, essentially because of the security. So it becomes more centralized, and also it just becomes – there's less history, right? It's more risky. Instead of moving along a horizontal spectrum – I don't understand why people aren't thinking more vertically. So you have the most secure chain, right? And it has the longest history, et cetera. And then building on top of it.
That's what Bitcoiners have been preaching this whole time. And that's what we're doing.
And so if you think of it as you can go horizontally, so you can take the idea of Bitcoin and replicate it with different, you know, criteria or different aspects, or you can go vertically, in almost every example in history, vertically integrating things has been valuable.
Right.
And like that's essentially what you're doing is you're vertically integrating some application with the core protocol. And so to me, it's just like naturally vertically integrating that is where the value is.
Right. I mean, I think there's trade-offs here in terms of security and censorship resistance versus centralization and cost.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to bring down costs, the more centralized, the cheaper it'll be. That's why, you know, Venmo is cheap or why Ripple is cheap. But if you want decentralization, you want distribution, you want censorship resistance, then it's going to cost you a little bit more. There's a trade-off there. That trade-off exists. It's not a solvable trade-off. But what you can do is if you do layers, then you can anchor into that chain that prioritizes censorship resistance, which is what I think all this is about. Like if you have to implement KYC chain-wide and stuff, it's all worthless. Mm-hmm. It's like there's no reason to use it. You can anchor into the main chain, and you can get the benefits from that while basically the users get to choose varying trade-offs of different things. Like, for instance, right now we have Liquid, which isn't really being used that much yet, and we have Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
Liquid is more like a Ripple, right? So it's a federated system,
mm-hmm.
but it uses Bitcoin as the token, right? Use LBTC, which is locked Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So
explain locked Bitcoin.
I mean, my understanding is like I'm pretty sure they lock it in a multi-sig address that mm-hmm. all the Federation controls.
Yep.
So you basically
it's almost like a claim on the Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Right?
But to have that Bitcoin stolen from you, you need like I don't know how many how many people they have involved, but like mm-hmm. 9 of 16 or something would have to collude to take your money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you're making a trade-off there, right? It is way more centralized than Bitcoin and even way more centralized than Lightning, but you'll have lower cost, faster transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do that on a, you know, there could be all sorts of things,
yep.
of all varying trade-offs that you'll be able to decide. And at the end of the day, you'll be using the best money that's ever existed, which is Bitcoin.
All right, I want to switch gears. We've talked about Wasabi, Samurai, Cash App. Are there any other products or services right now that you're like excited about or you think have, are worth paying attention to?
Well, I really like Lolli.
Okay. So for those that don't know, Lolli is basically when you make purchases, you get a percentage of the purchase back, kind of like a cash back type thing. But rather than get paid in US dollars, you get paid back in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
But what happens is like we live in a debt-based society, right? Mm-hmm. People spend way too much money and they shouldn't be. But like if they spend it through Lolli, then like it'll pump the Bitcoin price at the same time. So there's like this like interesting as a Bitcoin holder, it creates this interesting dynamic where not only does it onboard people really easily because yep. they don't have to worry about like actively buying it, they're just doing their day-to-day shopping.
Mm-hmm.
It creates this like I'm a fan of businesses that create like constant buy pressure.
Yep.
It like speeds up the whole process.
So Murad came on and Murad said something to me that was fascinating. He turned me on to this idea of if you're an individual, let's say you're a teacher, you're an accountant, you're, you know, pretty much 90%+ of professions in the world. you're asked to go to work every day. You get paid in your fiat currency. It sits in your bank account. And if you sit it there, it gets devalued away, right? So therefore, you are incentivized financially to figure out what to do with that currency and put it somewhere else, right? And so you can put it into real estate, you can put it in stocks, you can put it into bonds, whatever. If you're a teacher, you don't know anything about stocks, bonds, real estate, et cetera, unless you teach yourself, right? We're not taught that in the education system, whatever. His point was something like Bitcoin is perfect as a store of value. And because of the deflationary nature, it will actually accrue value over time. And so being able to not have to be a teacher and also educated in investing.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
You can just be a teacher and then you can store your wealth somewhere.
Save your money. You can just save your money and not have to worry about it. Like that, I get
and
that a lot.
And reduce the consumption, consumptionism, I think is the word, right? That you no longer are going to go out and spend it all the time, right? Which you're incentivized to do. Instead,
there's
you're going
a natural
to
incentive.
Yep.
And you know, I get that a lot of times, like, oh, you know, I don't get finance. Finance doesn't interest me. Like, that's why Bitcoin doesn't interest me. And really, those are like
the perfect
people. It's ideal for them.
And so Lolli helps you do that in a passive way, right? You just go about your day, you make the purchases you're going to make, and you are literally stacking sats over time.
Yeah. And it's just a very simple way to onboard people into Bitcoin. The other one that I think is a really important project is BTC Pay.
Okay, what is that?
So BTC Pay was born out of basically BitPay just continuously fucked us over and over again. And Dorier had this famous tweet where he like tweeted out, "You're dead to me, BitPay." Like, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not sure, but it's a great tweet. "I'm gonna make you obsolete." And he created BTC Pay along with a bunch of other people. It's an open source, all open source project. And basically the idea is that you could be your own merchant processor. It gives you everything you need all in one easy setup. You run your own node, you run your own Lightning node, you can set Bitcoin and Lightning, you can like integrate it into QuickBooks. So if you're a store owner, you can just accept Bitcoin yourself without using Coinbase, without using BitPay, without using any middleman. And obviously you're receiving Bitcoin though. So you can then convert that manually onto an exchange. But that goes back to our previous point where when you add the KYC, when you add the fiat banking element, that's where all these KYC attack vectors come in. That's where they start pushing you into KYC. So basically BTC Pay makes it super easy for anyone to accept Bitcoin. And what I think is the next step is they were talking about this on Twitter. Like one of the guys working on it was talking about it on Twitter a couple days ago. And like you can make it so that every BTC Pay merchant, let's say you're running a bodega, you're accepting Bitcoin. I actually think that the two main reasons people don't spend Bitcoin right now, well, besides the fact that they think the price is going to go up, is the tax obligations. It's like ridiculously cumbersome to have to like deal with that. So you might as well just pay with cash or card instead. And then the second thing is like they're converting it to fiat anyway. So you're not really supporting Bitcoin at all. But if you knew the merchant was going to keep his Bitcoin and he gives you a discount because he wants KYC, right? Like if you're a merchant, you want KYC for your Bitcoin, the best way is to all your products give a 10%, 5% discount on Bitcoin purchases. And then all of a sudden all your customers are giving you KYC for your Bitcoin, right? And then that merchant could actually start selling Bitcoin for cash. Because he has all this Bitcoin that he's receiving and he doesn't have a fiat off ramp, so he's sitting on all this volatility risk. He could then sell small amounts of Bitcoin through his store, and then we also all of a sudden have this like distributed KYC-less network that of merchants and consumers that would be hard to enforce any kind of regulations on them. You'd have to do it store by store, basically like how they do like cash non-reporting for stores as it is.
Hey everyone, Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.